Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've actually got three people we're going to talk to. Ben Cecil with the Louisville Nursery Association. He's their vice president. He owns a wholesale nursery down in Elizabethtown.
Good guy.
Yeah, great guy. Also, Dr. Rob Fergus, who is with Bird Be Gone. He's basically their ornithologist that will be overseeing their Ask the Bird Expert component that's on their website. So if you have a problem with birds, you can have somebody who really knows what they're talking about answer your specific problem. And then Greg Spickert on aquatic plants.
Yeah, Greg and his wife wrote a book about the Encyclopedia of Water Gardens. He knows a lot about water plants, and it'll be very helpful to fill that hole in our lives.
Get you set up in your beautiful water garden. All right, Bob, what is going on in your beautiful water garden and otherwise?
Funny you should mention that because you know, you talk a lot about your animals and stuff out in your place, and I saw my first frog fight ever.
Did you really?
Yeah, I've got the Bob Bog.
Were they mating or were they fighting?
Yes. No, they were. That was the whole deal.
You weren't quite sure.
They were fighting over mating.
Oh, okay.
But the Bob Bog is now up and running with the rain, and the frogs are terribly noisy. They must be mating. So I was down watching. There's about 40 or 50 of these frogs in my little bog, and I saw two frogs fighting while a female was off to the side, and they grabbed each other by the lips. And we're hurling each other around in the water. And one kind of flipped the other one away and then pounced upon the waiting female.
Because remember when we talked to Bern Heinrich, when we talked about Summer World, his book?
Yeah.
And he talked about the whole, like, frog pond thing and
it was amazing.
Intricacies of their life.
Yeah, I'd never seen a frog fight before, so
that's
that was cool.
That's awesome.
How about the Wishes State? What's up?
I've been harvesting weeds.
Oh.
How about that?
For what?
For food.
No.
Yeah. So
it's come to this, huh?
I had this beautiful crop of purslane.
Okay.
That started to grow in the kitchen garden, you know, the little raised garden that used to be the rose garden that's close to the house.
Yep.
And I just decided to let it go because it was contained in the little cold frame that I, you know, had from the wintertime there. It was contained in there. And it literally, and I know that it's pristine, you know, there aren't any chemicals or anything.
Right.
And I'm going to let this go, and I'm going to harvest it, and I'm going to look up recipes for purslane because I know that it's an edible. And, Bob, I made this fabulous potato, cucumber, and purslane salad.
Did Andy agree with you?
Yes, and I served it at the Plant Kingdom employee party that we hosted.
And nobody...
And the whole dish was, you know, nearly consumed.
Wow.
Kyle Young, a young friend of mine, I think he's 14, who's a great eater, because I'm like, here, Kyle, taste this. It's a weed. And he tastes, and he's like, this is pretty good. You know? So, like, if I can get this whole range of people eating it and enjoying it, guess what? Here's the kicker, too. High in omega-3 fatty acids.
Uh-oh.
High in vitamin C.
Yeah.
Helps lower your cholesterol and your blood pressure.
Other than that.
It's great.
Why isn't this stuff for sale in a supermarket somewhere?
Because Americans are funny about what they deem appropriate.
It's just a purslane weed.
It's got a reddish stem.
Okay.
It's often, you know, more spread out on the ground, but my crop was a little bit more upright. Reddish stem, very succulent in nature. It's portulaca.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So succulent in nature, and then little oval succulent-like green leaves.
I know exactly what you mean
And if you cook it, it actually, like, you can make a purslane gumbo, which I'm going to try, but not now because it's too hot out to make gumbo. But it has almost like an okra effect, but it makes things more kind of viscous.
So it's the same as portulaca. It's just called purslane is portulaca.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, if you know your general backyard weeds, you probably know what purslane is.
Okay.
And it's fabulous. I'm sold on it. I think I'm going to keep making purslane for dinner every night.
We're going to have the Wishy Weed Company coming here.
I don't know about that. I'll just enjoy my purslane at the farm.
Okay.
So yeah, take a chance on purslane, folks, if you like to cook. And if you, you know, just do a Google search with different purslane recipes, all kinds of stuff comes up. So it's pretty cool. All right. LNN, Louisville Nursery Association. Are you a member?
Yes, I am.
All right.
Hidden Hill's a proud member, and it's a good bunch of people.
Yeah.
it seems like all their meetings, I'm in the middle of something else. I don't go enough, but I know it's a close-knit bunch.
Yeah, networking.
And they really do help each other.
Yeah, good networking.
Yeah, networking and gardening and horticulture go together, and this bunch really personifies that.
So, and what they've done recently is launch a new website. It is LouisvilleNursery.org. It's mostly a listing of all their members, but they do provide links and other things. So Ben Cecil's joining us to tell us a little bit about this new website and the Louisville Nursery Association. Ben is their vice president. He's also the owner and operator of a wholesale nursery in Elizabethtown, Kentucky called Sunny Rays. Ben, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So you're vice president of the Louisville Nursery Association, so I guess that's how you got wrangled into helping develop this great website as a resource. But give our listeners an idea about who the Louisville Nursery Association is.
Well, we're a group of horticulturalists the organization was established in 1923. So it's one of the oldest horticultural organizations in the country, and it's a group of combination of nurserymen and landscapers, garden centers, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically socialize with each other and network, and it's a means for the growers to get the products out to the local business people and for them to get them out to the public, and everyone stay abreast of the latest and greatest things that go on.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the new launch is this new website that you all have. It's LouisvilleNursery.org. Tell us about that and what kind of resource it is.
Well, our goal is two-part for it. The first one that really affects a lot of your clientele or your listeners is it serves as a source to locate members for the LNA based on their discipline.
Mm-hmm.
For an example, if you're looking for an arborist, you have the opportunity to search our website and find an arborist who is a member of the LNA.
So it has to,
rather than thumbing through the yellow books and or yellow pages and taking a guess as to who you might want to use.
Mm-hmm. So the folks that are listed are members of LNA, not just any local business in the area, right?
Exactly.
So what are some of the other, you'd mentioned arborist, what are some of the other disciplines that are listed that people might be interested in?
Well, we have garden centers, so you can actually locate them. And another neat thing about the site is when you pull up the address of the member, you can actually locate by a map that's connected to a map, so you can actually find where the member's located.
Mm-hmm.
But we have garden centers, landscape design companies, commercial design companies, lawn care, and that's the bulk of it. There might be some consultants in there, but I'm not absolutely for sure.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some educational components of this where different schools and where people can go on and learn where to get information beyond
just a product.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. That's exactly right. We're actually... we keep a list of tips that are pertinent to the time of year. I'm actually about to update those here in the next day or two. And we keep a calendar of events that the member or public can see that will lay out certain activities that might go on at public areas such as Bernheim or Udale, and maybe if a local gardening organization has a program, we encourage them to contact us so that we can post that on our calendar. It lets our members realize some other learning potentials that are out there, but then also gets it out to the public in one more way.
All right, Ben. Sounds good. Ben Cecil is the vice president of the Louisville Nursery Association, and he's the owner and operator of Sunny Rays Nursery in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. It's a wholesale nursery. And the website is www.louisvillenursery.org. Thanks a lot, Ben. We appreciate your
time. Thanks,
Ben. Thank you all for speaking with me.
Uh-huh. All right, Bob, from one website resource...
We'll fly down the road to another one.
To another website resource, Bird Be Gone, on their website has a new component, Ask the Bird Expert, and we actually have one of the PhD ornithology experts joining us today, who's recently been hired to answer people's specific
Which
problems.
It's a real problem because birds are so used to humans now that they're just... part of our lives.
Sure.
Didn't used to be that way.
And
they go to places and they're found in places they never used to be before.
That's right.
And we don't want them there all the time.
All the time. And it's very,
some birds especially.
Right. Do we want them pecking on our house or eating our crops? No.
Or
but
worse.
There's ways to manage, sure. So Dr. Rob Fergus is joining us. He is an ornithologist who specializes in urban ecology and human-wildlife interactions. He teaches at Rowan University in New Jersey and Rosemont College in Philadelphia, and he's been hired by Bird Be Gone to field and answer questions from consumers with their Ask the Bird expert resource. Rob, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah. Listen, give us a little bit of your background. You're an ornithologist, recently brought into the Bird Be Gone family to assist customers in their bird-human relations. But how long have you been playing around with the bird thing and teaching people about ornithology?
Well, I got my PhD from the University of Texas in Austin, and I got my master's there as well, and I've been studying human-bird interactions for the last 12 years.
Okay.
But before that, I've been a bird watcher my whole life, so very actively watching birds and being engaged with that, leading field trips, and so helping people with their connection with birds for more than 20 years.
Yeah. So what are the primary problems reported, I guess, by institutions, municipalities, you know, individuals, farmers, gardeners, when it comes to bird-human interaction?
There's a lot of standard things that come up, and usually it's a bird being where it's not wanted. Things that typically come up are birds on buildings that shouldn't be on buildings. Maybe they're causing a mess with their droppings. The Canada goose problem in parks is a big one that comes up. And the one that comes up this time of year is mockingbirds singing all night long. That gets people a little bit upset when they can't sleep.
Uh-huh.
So those are some standard things. Bird Be Gone really started as a company dealing with creating plastic bird spikes to keep birds off of buildings as an alternative to metal spikes. And have grown to deal with other issues, but primarily started getting birds off of buildings. That's the easiest thing to probably control, because you can change the structure of a building so the birds can't land there or make it otherwise unattractive. Keeping birds out of landscapes that we've created that look perfect to them is a challenge. One case with that is with fruit crops. I mean, this is the traditional bird problem, is the scarecrow. You know, how do you keep birds out of your corn crop or whatever crop like that? We always talk about, if you could build a better mouse trap, the world would, you know, beat a path to your door. Well, we're working on better scarecrows, and it's the same type of issue.
And you run into the, for lack of a better phrase, the bird hugger syndrome, or like Louisville had 5 or 10 years ago, starlings in downtown buildings that were just a mess, and yet the methods used to get rid of them had some people who love birds worried that they're destroying the animals. How do you deal with that element of thought?
Well, it's a big issue, and sometimes even in conservation you get a conflict between the conservation needs and animal welfare people's interests in making sure individual animals are not harmed. In this case, Bird Be Gone is committed to humane solutions. We don't want to hurt the birds whenever possible. Now, in the case of starlings and English sparrows and pigeons, those are non-protective, non-native species. So it is legal to have lethal control and to kill those animals. And for other animals, sometimes there can be permits issued to deal with them. There's been cases where it's been necessary to kill Canada geese or other animals that are causing a nuisance. But that should only be in a last resort situation, and there are many ways to get rid of things before you have to go to that.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town. I remember back in the 50s where they just get 10 guys with shotguns in the middle of Main Street and blow up the pigeons, which seems,
in retrospect. Yeah, there's a song about poisoning pigeons in the park that's pretty funny from a musical. And you know, this may be a red state, blue state issue sometimes, or urban, rural. Yeah. You know, a lot of people are just like, well, shoot, I got a gun. I can handle this problem myself. First off, you know, there are laws, so we are committed to legally dealing with these things, and most species are legally protected. The pigeons, sparrows, and starlings are not. But
gun, so maybe not the best idea.
We need legal solutions. We need solutions that are humane, and that's what we're trying to do.
So, I just have enduring memories of that one.
So, yeah. Rob, what are some of the innovations that Bird Be Gone has come up with over the years, you know, since the plastic spikes?
Well, the plastic spikes were the start, and, you know, the thing that's really great about Bird Be Gone is we have a money-back guarantee. So if we've got something that doesn't work, you can send it back. And that's one way we know what's working and what's not working.
Sure,
and
yeah.
we provide things that we develop or that others develop that are proven to work. So one thing that Bird Be Gone didn't develop but that we have available is a chemical solution that you can put on your lawn that tastes bad to birds. It doesn't taste bad to us. In fact, it comes from grapes. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ingredients that's used to make artificial sweeteners. And to us, it tastes sweet, but to geese, it tastes nasty. So you can spray that on a lawn where geese are feeding, and if you do it right, they'll leave.
Hmm.
So that's a case where you can take something that's really attractive to these birds, you know, a lawn that they can just munch on, and make it unattractive by altering the taste.
Mm-hmm.
Bird Be Gone developed an electrical track system that you can put in some places where the birds, if they step on it, will get a little jolt.
Hmm.
And that's harmless to the birds. It's like putting an electric fence up.
Sure.
And those are some examples of things that, you know, it's a constant, and this is one thing I love about this work. It's a science, but it's also an art, and you get to experiment, and you get to try to see what works, and you have to really get into the mind of the bird. You know, what is the bird thinking, and how is it, why is it here? It's only going to be in a location because that location is providing something for it. So what is the bird getting out of the situation, and how can you take that away in this case?
So can we set up some scenarios then, Rob, you know, based on that, trying to figure out what the bird is after?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have an alternate sort of experience at my farm where I have blueberries, and we have a question from a listener. Actually, I'll throw it out to you because she's having major problems, Marion Fletcher. But she writes, I started 5 blueberry plants 5 years ago. I understand I had to wait several years to get a good crop of blueberries. I found real fast that the birds love blueberries. I tried covering the plants with netting. The netting got caught in the branches and I could not pick. This year I'm using a plastic fence around the plants with the netting, but she's finding that birds and butterflies still get in at the bottom and are getting caught and dying. So, she's troubled with the whole netting thing. Alternately, and this is where I really want your assessment of the behavior of birds. This is the first year that I can remember in our blueberry and blackberry patch that I have not had any significant bird pressure. And, every day I keep waiting. I'm going to go out there and, you know, everything's going to be gone, because that usually is what happens. You know, just one day, you know, cedar waxwings come in or something. We have a prairie now, and this brings in lots of birds that are insect eaters. And is there a relation or, a correlation, I should say, between more insect-eating birds perhaps in the area, which would reduce maybe seed and berry-eating birds? Or is that just crazy?
That's a tough one to answer without looking at the very specifics of your location.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I would hazard to guess that there is going to be a correlation.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, to prove that would take a couple of years of study, and there it's hard to eliminate all the other variables that might be at play. You know,
right.
I don't know what the cedar waxwing population is like in your area this year, because they move around.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be an issue. Could be that there's lots of other fruit available, depending on the rainfall that you've had this year.
Sure.
So it would take some serious looking to figure that out. But in general, if you are going to have a more natural landscape with lots of opportunities for lots of different birds, you're probably going to reduce the impact that birds are going to have on your crops.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is if there's nothing around at all except for your little patch of berries, they're going to go for it, because it's going to stand out as a sore thumb. They're going to go for it. As for the listener who has problems with the netting, I'd have to look exactly at what size netting and the situation that she has. I mean, basically, for blueberries and other berries, if you're having bird pressure, netting is really going to be the only thing that's going to keep them out. You can try all the things to scare them away, But really, if there's berries there that they really, really want, they're gonna get it. Yeah. I mean, just think of it as the policeman on the side of the road. If you know there's a policeman on the side of the road, you're probably not going to go speeding by. Mm-hmm. But if you go zipping along and you see the police car on the side of the road and you slow down, but as you go past, you realize, hey, look, it's just one of those inflatable fake cop cars.
Right.
It's not going to stop you tomorrow. And these birds, especially birds that are in their home territory, you stick something up there, they're going to be wary at first, but if it doesn't move, if it doesn't ever actually hurt anything, mm-hmm. they're going to figure out that it's fake. So any of those scarecrow type of things are only going to have limited effectiveness. Yeah, it might work for a little while, mm-hmm. but then they're going to figure it out. And so you're going to have to try something else, move it along. It's going to be an ongoing battle.
Yeah.
So netting is the way to go. As far as birds getting in underneath, you do have to have it anchored down so that they can't get under there. So it needs to be installed correctly. We'd have to look at how she's got it mm-hmm. on there. Does she have it just hanging on the bush, or does she have it on a frame over the bush? You know, if you put it on a frame of wood or PVC piping or something so that the netting is 6 inches away from the bush, and also so that you can lift it up and pick the berries easily, that's going to be most effective for you and to keep the birds mm-hmm. out. So we'd have to look exactly at the setting. Yeah. You can't just throw a net over and expect everything right. to be fine. It needs to be installed perfectly. Mm-hmm. As far as for birds getting tangling, we'd have to see what kind of birds it is, what kind of netting it is. And the great thing about Bird Be Gone is you can call us and describe the exact situation that you've got going on, and there'll be someone there to take your question and help you think through what you need to do. So,
yeah. Rob, let me back you up to the Canadian goose thing again, because I can think off the top of my head three or four or five little lakes or ponds in parks or in private homes where they're a perpetual nuisance.
Yes.
And you mentioned some product you can spray on the grass, but how expensive is that? And you have to do it every time it rains, you have to do it again. Is there a long-range solution to deal with these? And particularly in a public park where kids are walking around on this, and there's hundreds of geese
yeah, no,
crapping all over the lawn. What do you do about that?
It's a huge problem that's arisen in the last few decades. We've got these big populations now of non-migratory geese. It used
right.
to be the geese would come and go, but you know, we were trying to build up the populations, and one of the unintended consequences is we've established these non-migratory populations now, and they do just get in the way. What we really have to do is think about it from the goose's perspective. You know, you got a lake where they're safe to go floating out there, right next to a lawn where they can munch on it.
Right.
And that's like, you know,
heaven.
Opening up a buffet and putting Lazy Boys in there right next to it. You know,
right.
It's like the perfect, perfect Shangri-La for geese. The best thing to do is to alter the landscape so that it's less attractive to them. You know, take away the Lazy Boy, take away the buffet, and the birds will go. I mean, just think about it. When was the last time you saw a big flock of Canada geese walking through the underbrush in the forest?
Right.
I mean, you just don't see that. Now, you can't necessarily
yeah.
plant a lot of bushes and trees right next to the lake in a public park setting, but you can do some of that. If you can put cattails along the edge of the pond, or you can put bushes along the edge of the pond so it's harder for the geese to get from the pond to the lake, or even they have thin wire fencing that you can set up that can break the landscape so the geese can't just waddle from where they eat over to the pond. Or you can plant different kinds of grass that are less attractive to them. It's really landscape alteration is the best long-term thing you can do with geese. If you insist on having a pond with a grassy slope next to it, you're gonna have an ongoing battle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, what about birds and the homeowner? You talked about earlier that you also help people create landscapes that are going to attract birds, and certainly
mm-hmm.
that's what we always like to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've created a situation in terms of my house being desirable to woodpeckers because it's Western cedar.
Yeah.
So are there any good Bird Be Gone tips in terms of managing woodpeckers pecking on your house?
Yeah, and if you go to our website, there's information there, but there's several things that can happen with woodpeckers. They can find that your house is a nice place to make noise because they don't sing, they drum. That's what they're doing when they're just drilling really fast on your house. And so if your house is a good drum, they may make some damage just by doing that.
Okay.
They might be on your house if you have an insect mm-hmm. infestation, if you've got carpenter bees or something that are in your mm-hmm. actual sighting, they're going to be attracted to those. You got to make sure you don't have any of that going on.
That happened one year actually really badly.
Yeah.
Some little downy woodpeckers just like gouged out the frame of the garage door because they were after the carpenter bees.
Yeah, so you got to make sure you're not again providing a food source for them. So get your house treated if that's going on. Uh-huh. Occasionally they'll just drill a hole because they think they can make a hole in there to nest. That's a lot less common, but sometimes it happens. The trick is usually to try to alter the structure of your building in a way so that so the birds can't land on there. If there's one specific place where it's drumming or it's mm-hmm. drilling, can you put up some netting to keep it from actually landing on there and causing the damage? Or there's bird scare devices, little balloons mm-hmm. with streamers that sometimes work. Again, the bird may figure out that it's not actually a threat and just mm-hmm. get used to it and come back if the incentive is there stronger for them to, you know, it's a balance, just like us.
Sure,
you know, you're hungry,
absolutely.
But you want to watch TV. Well, you're going to watch TV until you get so hungry that you just absolutely have to go get some food. It's the same with them. You know, it's like, okay, they're scared, but they're hungry. You know, they're confused, but then they get hungry.
Yeah.
Or, you know, as long as you leave the fridge door open, they're going to come. So the best thing to do is to block off whatever access you can to the part of your building that's really attracting them, if that's feasible. If it's not feasible, you're gonna have an ongoing battle to try to put up devices that might scare them away.
But often they're after some sort of insects, probably,
if
more than
they're
anything
after
else.
An insect,
yeah.
Then,
so
yeah,
look,
you gotta
go
block,
to the root of the
get
problem.
Get rid of the insects and we'll block their access. If they're just drumming on your house, you know, is it a hollow thing that sounds really good to them that you can mm-hmm. fix by putting up some metal flashing or something, or so they can't actually perch on the side of the mm-hmm. house where they are, or that alters the sound? And you have to do some experimentation sometimes. That's why I said it's an art as much as a science.
What about the birds that attack their image in the window?
Yeah, that's an ongoing thing. Like
with kamikaze cardinals
and American robins, they see their image there, and so you got to block that reflective quality of your car mirror or your car door or your windows in your house. You know, it sounds nasty, but you know, the easiest thing to do is just get a bar of soap and just wipe it all over your window until they go away.
It's a seasonal thing, right? Just a mating kind of
thing. They're just all ramped up on their hormones, and they see their reflection. They think
it's
somebody they got to drive away. So if you can block, and you got to do this on the outside of the window, because if you do it on the inside of your window, that outside is still reflective. So put some soap on there, or put some other kind of screening on there that. Whatever's going to work for you that's going to drop the reflectivity of the window down so that they can't see themselves in there.
Because they do usually use this exact same reflective surface, don't they?
Yeah, they get used to seeing that there, and they just come back more and more to just try to drive it away. It's just like driving them crazy. It's like they're stuck in a little loop.
That's so funny. Soap's a good idea. Thank you, Rob. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been great to be here. Thanks.
Great. Dr. Rob Fergus is an ornithologist who specializes in urban ecology and human-wildlife interactions. He teaches at Rowan University in New Jersey and Rosemont College in Philadelphia and has been hired by Bird Be Gone to field and answer questions from consumers with their Ask the Bird Expert resource. And, of course, for more information on that, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, aquatic author and expert Greg Spickert will offer some tips on creating a great water garden in your yard. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill. It's time to get all wet, isn't it, kid?
It is, and I suspect that some people have trouble with their aquatic life getting snagged by birds.
I can't swim very well. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, different things coming down to munch on your koi and such. But
Right. Hey,
maybe you can... provide some protection for your aquatic life.
Good thought.
With plants.
Yeah, and we've got just a guy to tell us. His name is Greg Spickert. He's an avid plant breeder. He holds a degree in horticulture from Purdue University, has introduced more than 300 new hardy and tropical marginals and over 100 new native water plants. He's also a director of the Hilltop Garden and Nature Center in Bloomington, Indiana, and he's with us today to talk about how to grow water plants. Greg, welcome to Homegrown.
Yes, thank you very much.
What a great background. You went to Purdue and worked with plants above ground and then below water both. How did that happen? Fill us in a little bit.
Well, I started with plants when I was about 6 years old with my grandfather working on his Cymbidium orchids, and he gave me one to start with. Mm. So I started way back then, and what people would think was the hardest things to start with, but orchids are really actually pretty easy depending on what you start with. And then I went from there.
All the way to Purdue and actually wrote a book on water plants, which we'll talk about a little later. But how about water gardening itself? Has it been around since Cleopatra in the Nile as part of human existence?
Oh, yeah. It's been around since the Moors and way back then. And it was basically to bring coolness into the garden and an aesthetic, you know, and irrigation and provide basically indoor plumbing, as you would say, for like the courtyard, so you would have water to work with.
So, Greg, let me ask you before we get into the more cultivated varieties of plants that people enjoy in, you know, constructed water gardens, what about just some of the good old native standbys that, you know, if you have a farm pond or small lakes sort of thing, you could get some interesting plants started?
Oh, yeah. There's some wonderful stuff. Things you never want to put in a farm pond are lotus.
Uh-huh.
Because they're like the quack grass, you know, of the water garden.
Okay.
They kind of take over. But really nice plants are, you know, nuphars and pickerel plants and, you know, some of the selections of water lilies. Those are all nice, you know, to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a lot of really neat things to work with. Most of my book was native plant material because there are so many really fun things.
Reasonably speaking, would a handful of those things naturally occur in a farm pond setting?
Cattails always naturally occur.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, because they can be either blown in or brought in on the feet of waterfowl.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the other plants are flood-in, so unless your farm pond gets flooded from a stream or a lake that already has those plants in it, it's probably never going to make it there.
Okay. So what if we look at the value of these plants in this water, you know, ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
What function are they playing?
Well, in the native natural selection, what we're talking about is we're adding a food source for butterflies and animals, and you know, hiding places for frogs and different amphibians and fish to spawn and things like that. We're providing seeds for the birds to eat. We're providing a root mass that holds the banks in place so we can prevent erosion.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at plant material that allows the ecosystem to handle some amount of waste working into it and being dumped into it, you know, like leaves and fish, you know, manure,
mm-hmm.
so that all that can be recycled and put into plant material.
So it kind of creates a healthier sort of pond if you've got...
Most definitely
creates
a healthier pond.
Yeah, to that end, I had illusions of having a pond in my place called Mr. Hooper's Pond for my neighbor, but it leaks, and it's become now the Bob Bog. And so I worry about planting water plants that are periodically flooded, and then the water goes away. I mean, can they hold their breath for a couple weeks at a time?
Some of them can. Cattails are probably the best example of that, but other plants like nuphars can do much better than water lilies, so if you have that seasonal flooding. Other plants like hibiscus and Asclepias incarnata, the swamp milkweeds, those do really well. So, and then some of the different sedges and rushes, like soft rush and star sedge and stuff like that.
One other worry I have is that I've got a bunch of trees over my pond, which I wouldn't have done initially, but that's where the pond went. It had to go that way. I get a lot of fall leaves in the pond, and I'm afraid it's going to suck up or eat up all the oxygen when they're decaying. Is that a valid worry, and what can I do about that?
That is a valid worry. And one of the things you can do is by either adding aeration through adding an artificial waterfall or
a
pond pump.
Okay.
Yeah. Or the other thing, too, is try to remove some of the leaves.
Or maybe net it?
Yeah, net it if you can. The other thing to do, the main thing is if you're going to net it, make sure that the leaves don't touch the water, because then it's like a giant tea bag. And we've released all the nutrients into the water, which is a bigger component of why we lose oxygen, because all that nitrogen and all those nutrients need oxygen to be processed.
So what are you doing late November?
Probably cleaning out someone else's pond. Yeah.
All right. So, okay, back to the backyard pond.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Greg, if somebody's interested in, you know, getting started, what do they need to consider?
They need to consider their site. The most important thing they need to consider is what do they want their pond to do? Is it going to be for wildlife? Is it going to be aesthetic, just to grow plants? Is it going to be just for the sound of water? Or is it going to be for fish?
Mm-hmm.
All of those mean something different. And you can have a pond that has many of those components, but they all have a design issue that has to be met. If you're going to have fish, the pond needs to be as big as possible. If you want to have sound, then we need to face it a certain direction. We have to have a certain amount of water movement. Because simply dropping, you know, a quarter inch of water from a high place is still only a quarter inch of water. Mm-hmm. You want to hear something really loud, you need 6,000 gallons an hour.
Whoosh.
Yeah.
In a bathroom close by.
Huh? Right.
So. What about, like, you know, Bobby talked about the leaf factor, but what about just, like, full sun, part shade, you know, shade? Is that going to... Because I would think, quite frankly, when you manufacture one,
mm-hmm.
the challenges could be greater than your farm pond that exists on its own.
Well, the issue is with a farm pond, it is simply generally a larger artificial pond.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on how you've constructed it. But if there's not a lot of water outflow from a farm pond, it can be sometimes worse.
Okay.
But generally with a smaller pond, I generally don't put any stone on the bottom of a pond because that way I can clean it every year. I can get the leaves out, the extra algae, I can transplant my plants. Mm-hmm. And the liner's black, so you don't really notice it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just makes the pond look deeper. You can put a few rocks on the bottom if you want,
but
I generally don't. Mm-hmm. Shade, if I'm going to only have fish and I just need to hear sound. If I'm going to have plants and plants is the major reason to have it, then I need to make sure that I have as much sun as possible.
Okay.
There's not a lot of trees in the middle of lakes and ponds,
right.
So
right.
The plants aren't really heavily adapted to shade. You know, so water lilies, you know, just not a big shade thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are considerations you need to make. You'll have definitely less algae and problems if you're going to keep fish in the shade, but that doesn't prevent it from sneaking up on you. Algae is an indication of something that's out of balance, and if it's not growing and you're kind of masking that imbalance, all of a sudden what will happen is your fish just float to the surface dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's probably not the way you want to find out something's wrong.
Yeah, speaking of floating to the surface dead, I tried koi twice and with dismal results both times. And I'm wondering, so I just went to goldfish. Is that a mm-hmm. cop-out, or will that work from year to year, just keeping the goldfish around?
Goldfish are fine. In fact, I only had longfin koi when people gave them to me.
Yeah.
I was perfectly happy with, you know, fancy goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
They're smaller, and I can have more in a pond. But generally, you're looking at a 6-inch fish takes 200 gallons of water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and most people put, you know, they have a 150-gallon pond, they have 12 fish in there.
Yeah, I didn't know
that. They look great, but it's also almost impossible to keep it clean.
Okay, so is there a similar ratio in terms of so many gallons of water compared to how many plants you can pack into your pond?
Actually, there isn't, which okay. is nice because you can, you know, in a container, you can cram it full mm-hmm. as long as there's enough water in the container.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, although one caveat, I have actually seen a pond that I probably would have removed some plants from because I couldn't tell that there was any water in it. So it would have been nice to let, you know, kind of like those hidden, you know, like quicksand mm-hmm. with plants.
You have been to my house.
So, Greg, when you put your plants in, are they set in the water just in their pots, or are they actually, like, planted or afloat in some way, or does it just depend on what the plant is?
I've done it many different ways. If the pond's large enough, I've made islands that float and then have the plants in the middle, and that gives the fish some shade and gives some structure to the pond that's mm-hmm. maybe very large. I've planted bogs that are built into the sides so that the side plantings look very natural and are watered from the pond. I've left them just in containers and put them on a shelf. I find containers on a shelf tend to attract raccoons, because what frogs and amphibians tend to do is hide in between the pots.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of, if there's a bog planting on the edge, if a raccoon comes, the the amphibians tend to swim out into the pond, but if there's pots, they tend to swim into the pots.
Okay, and then the raccoons.
Right, and then you end up with, you know, basically a kit in the end, because it's mud, rocks, pots, and plants all floating in the pond the next day. Right.
Okay, and then the fish, how deep should the pond be? Talk about the fish lifestyle where it has to winter over. How do they do that?
Well, generally, if you're going to just have goldfish or small koi, and koi and fish aren't the big issue, you're going to want something that's at least 2 feet to 30 inches deep. And then for me, if I'm going to have a koi pond, I'm going to want it at least 5 feet deep.
Wow.
So yeah, because 5 feet is going to give it, you know, in warmer areas of the country like us, and we're getting warmer every year, they're cold water fish. So we don't want water in the 90s. So the deeper the pond, the cooler it can stay. So, and you don't want it really shallow because, you know, basically if you want to raise Victorias and get your water up into the 90s, you have a 6-inch deep pond that's really wide, and that's not conducive to growing. That's great for growing guppies, but not really good for growing goldfish.
Okay, I'm a new fish garden, water garden newbie, and I want to start out here. Give me 4 or 5 basic plants I should use and how I should use them.
Okay, basic plants you want to get, you want to make sure that you get some kind of oxygenators. They don't really produce oxygen. They remove minerals, but they do produce oxygen, but not nearly enough for the fish. But you're going to want some kind of submerged plant. Generally, I like to use Vallisneria or Sagittarius subulata, one of the submerged Sagittarius. I want a nice water lily. Pick whatever color you want. They all basically grow the same. Some of the newer hybrids are nicer. You're going to want pickerel plant because it's really beautiful and it blooms, and there's about 9 different colors. You're going to want a grassy plant of some sort, a sedge, to help remove as much nitrogen as possible. So that can be a dwarf or miniature or full-size cattail, but depending on what you want, or an umbrella grass if you want to make sure you remove it every year and you get that kind of tropical look. Or you can use a native like soft rush or any one of those. And then I would try to get a floater of some sort, you know, whether it be water hyacinth, which we never put into a native area, or one of the other floating little plants that, you know, give you something like that. You can also use some of the native floating plants, which would be like bog bean, which is a great little plant, or Caltha palustris, which is another one that makes a great little plant for that.
Then there's the chemical treatment. The water's got too much algae, not enough algae. I'm getting duckweed. How do you deal with it? What do you tell people about chemicals?
Well, when I tell people about chemicals is, remember, if you're killing algae, it's a plant, and anything you use to kill algae is going to try to kill your other plant.
Okay.
So if we're going to use copper, we're going to be trying to kill our fish and kill our plants. That's not cool.
No.
So, you know, when we read about copper sulfate to keep your pond all crystal clear, one, it turns it blue, which is interesting, but definitely not cool.
Right.
And then, so I tend to try to tell people, work on keeping the pond clean through filtration. Work on using a little bit of hydrogen peroxide, and that'll do wonders for keeping the string algae down and keeping your algae population down. And try to plant enough plants that can absorb all the nutrients. If you have issues with your fish, there's some really great antibiotics that you want to do, just like anything, like if you have a cat or a gerbil or something that needs medication. Generally better in their food than just the prophylactic in the water. We don't want to salt our pond unless it's just for fish, because salt kills plants. We're not putting an ocean in, so we want to make sure that the plants... Yeah, this isn't off the coast of Miami, so when we start adding salt, that's what happens. So little things like that, you know, just remember the cleanest water is the best water. If you can run your downspouts from your house into your pond, that would be great, because every time it rains, it'll help rinse out your pond.
That's a great
idea. Okay, one last quick question, because I know you're director of the Hilltop Garden and Nature Center in Bloomington. Give us about 30 seconds on that and why we should go see it.
Well, we're a garden that's here at Indiana University to try to help people learn about gardening. We've missed 2 generations almost now of people that aren't gardening. What we want to do is show people the opportunities that they have growing tropicals in a Midwestern climate, and how great they look all the way until October. We teach kids how to garden. We do outreach to the schools. And we always have something fun because we're an art school. So we have like an indigo farm. We've got towers made out of glass that are recycled. We've got bananas this year. Got giant leaves that are cast in concrete. So we always have something fun.
Greg, thanks a lot, man. A lot of help here.
Okay, thanks.
Greg Spikert and his wife Sue are authors of the Encyclopedia of Water Gardening Plants, and Greg is also director of the Hilltop Garden and Nature Center in Bloomington, Indiana. For more information on Greg, his book, or the center, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we've got a question from a Karen Cryan, and she's got some good detail in here, and it's probably a problem that some other people have in terms of western and northwestern exposure, which is that hot afternoon sun. But she is looking for some plants for her front yard, and she's open to any type of plant, really, she says. The front yard of my Cape Cod faces northwest, so it is challenging to find plants that can take the wild swing in sun and temperature. Shade in the AM, and then it's blasted in the PM, but not always for 6 hours, right, as needed for full sun plants. So the ones that want full sun are always reaching for it, and then they look lopsided.
Right.
So she knows it's a difficult situation, but she's wondering if we have any ideas in terms of plants that might do okay in this, you know, a little bit of full baking sun, but not long enough. It's like baking for 2 hours in the afternoon kind of thing.
Yeah, I have some areas like that myself. I didn't have them initially, but my trees got big enough. Mm-hmm. There's some openings like from 1 to 3 or 2 to 4 or 2 to 6, and I get blasted. And I try in general to keep things that are lower growing. And she's right, the taller plants will reach toward the sun and kind of mess, mm-hmm, you up. So, like, I'll use some little smaller grasses. They seem to work well in those things. Even the festica, the light blue one, I use a lot. Even daylilies work for me in those areas. As long as they, mm-hmm, get that 2 or 3 hours of direct sun, some of the smaller daylilies don't reach too much. So generally, I just look for lower perennials that, mm-hmm, you know, they seem to work for me.
Yeah, I've got some shrub ideas. And basically, I was thinking about shrubs that can tolerate full sun to part shade, so you won't have that you know, necessary full sun thing. And then I was thinking about plants that had foliage that was like a little bit more rugose or rough or sort of thick, because they'll be able to hold up to that blast of afternoon sun a little bit better, and also equally to winter winds and desiccation, because that west northwestern, the winter winds are going to jam you up more than anything else too.
Right.
So abelia, like the glossy abelia, there's a new hybrid called Rose Creek,
yep,
that's really good.
I've got it.
I think there's a couple in the series, so there's something Creek.
Blooming right now.
So that, right, it's a good summer bloomer.
Yeah, beautiful plant.
And it's pretty tough, you know?
It's real tough.
So that's one. Taxus are always going to hold up pretty well, but not very exciting. A bunch of different types of viburnum. The only thing with the viburnum is that you would have to actively prune those to keep them looking good. So there's, you know, the Mohawk viburnum, their Kanoi viburnum, a cranberry viburnum, Korean spice viburnum, a bunch of different ones. You just kind of have to take a look at what you think you like. Deciduous hollies would probably do pretty well.
They'll
tough
take
plant.
Full apart, son.
Yeah, absolutely.
These all get tall, but, mm-hmm, I think they'll still work there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on where you want them. Do you want them out in the front yard? Do you want them up against the house?
Right.
Calacanthus, Carolina allspice. There's one called Athens that's really fragrant.
That should
hold up, I think, in the afternoon sun as well. So as long as you keep everything really well watered as they establish, I would think those plants might get you good.
Good enough.
So, yeah. All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, we're slowly crawling our way toward the end of the show. What will be your Latin word of the week?
Latin word of the week this week is repens, which means creeping.
Creeping or crawling.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Creeping along the ground.
Yep.
I wonder if that purslane is portulaca repens, because it actually creeps along the ground, but I'm not entirely sure.
I wonder if sinners that repent are creeping and crawling along.
They probably are.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
They're repenting, they're creeping and crawling.
Sure. And if a plant is repent, it means that it's... creeps along, repent behavior.
It's on its way to heaven.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, Opuntia repens.
Oh, yeah, good one. Creeping prickly pear.
Panicum repens.
Torpedo grass. You ever seen that?
I haven't.
I haven't either.
Salix repens.
Creeping willow.
There's always a creeping willow,
there's a place for that, though, yeah.
Ranunculus repens.
The creeping buttercup. That sounds cool.
Veronica repens.
Creeping Veronica.
Mm-hmm. This almost looks like chickweed. Little white blooms in late spring.
That's not all good.
Well, it just looks like chickweed. It isn't chickweed, but it's got that sort of tiny, dainty effect. How's that?
Right.
Mahonia repens.
This one I've had. It's a neat plant. The creeping mahonia, kind of a low evergreen ground cover.
Mm-hmm.
Those yellow blooms and the fruit, grape-like fruit in the summer.
Yeah. All right, so if you see repens, I think a very useful Latin word to know, don't you?
Yeah.
Repens, it means that it's going to be creeping along the ground.
Simple. Easy to remember.
It is easy to remember. Think about that repent thing. So.
They're on their way to salvation.
There we go. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to do our summer home canning out at the farm. I think I've got three different things I want to show you, and they're all come from that Terre Vivant, the Gardeners of Terre Vivant cookbook.
Oh, wow.
So old-fashioned methods, okay?
So Janine cans and Bob quips.
Yes.
So it's going to happen, I promise
you. It's going to happen. All right. Uh-huh.
Homegrown is produced by the never-creepy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.